Well, good morning, United. It's great to be together for another Sunday. We had a great Sunday last week for Easter. It was our largest crowd since being in here, and it was a great morning together. And we had, if you were here with us, these two containers on the side of the stage filled with jelly beans. And we did a little jelly bean contest where we asked you to guess how many jelly beans were in them, and somebody came within four jelly beans. So the number was 4,502. So to come within four of that many jelly beans is pretty impressive. He is a mathematician. So maybe you should recruit him down to Samaritan Woman. He probably had some mathematical ability. His name's Mike. He's actually a volunteer back in our kids' area. So we have a service you probably don't know about at 9 o'clock. We do the same thing at 9 o'clock for our volunteers because we have a handful of volunteers that help out here on Sunday mornings that aren't able to be in this service at this time. And so he was able to get that this morning and pass that along to him. And so that's another service. And when you volunteer here and you're wondering, like, hey, what happens with the volunteers? Do they never go to church, you know, for as long as they volunteered? No, they have their own service. We feed them spiritually here in the same way that we want to feed all of each other when we gather together here at United Church. I want to introduce you to somebody this morning. His name's AJ. I don't know if you've ever met AJ or know AJ. Picture of AJ Jacobs. Anybody know AJ Jacobs before? So you might have heard a little bit about him. I learned about him through a book that I was reading where he kind of calls himself a human guinea pig. And what he means by that is that he immerses himself into a certain lifestyle or project, and he's the experiment. He's the guinea pig. And so he'll get into a certain lifestyle where he kind of learns about something and writes about it. So he calls it stunt journalism or immersion journalism. And so, for example, one year he learned about everything he could learn about by reading the Encyclopedia Britannica, 32 volumes. So the entire year, that's all he did with his life, is read the Encyclopedia. So he could be the smartest person alive. And so he writes this book becoming the smartest person alive. And I don't know that he actually became the smartest person, but he made the New York Times best-selling list for 8 weeks with this book. And then the next year, he decided he wanted to outsource his life. So not just outsource like a job or a responsibility, but his entire life. So not just his job and emails, but even dealing with his wife, he outsourced to somebody in India, reading his kids' bedtime stories. He outsourced to another person in India, and it was all the country of India that he outsourced his life to. I have no idea how long it was, but he wrote a piece about that, about outsourcing his life. And then the other thing that he's done a number of different writings, but one that's of interest for us this morning is something called The Year of Living Biblically. And so he immersed himself into the story of the Bible. And specifically, he took a month to learn all the different rules of the Bible and all the different laws. He went to a Christian bookstore, got a bunch of Bibles and study guides, and he wrote down every single rule and law in the Bible. And he took it at face value, and he said, for the next year, I'm going to live this way. And so he followed the Bible, the way that it's read in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and he lived out all of these different rules. And so some of these rules were, let me give you a couple of examples. One is that you don't shave the side of the hair on the side of your head for men. And that's a custom. And so if you see Orthodox Jewish men, they'll have long hair here. And so he basically looked like a hipster that year because he just grew a full beard. The other thing that he did is he stopped wearing clothes with mixed fibers. All of us this morning are probably wearing clothes of mixed fibers. He started to play the harp and the shofar to begin his day. Get this. Then he refused to shake the hands of any women because he was worried that it might be their time of the month. And so that's a law, like it's ceremonial unclean, that time of the month for women. And so he didn't want to come in contact. Thankfully, he worked with a group of ladies that were very sympathetic, and they put an Excel spreadsheet together of their time of the month so that he could know when he had to avoid them or not. So on your welcome card this morning, ladies, if you can go ahead, totally kidding, don't do that. But his craziest activity was this, because there's, you know, laws about different types of lifestyles, and one was for an adulterer. If you were caught in adultery, you would be stoned. And so he lived in New York City and works in New York City, and he just assumed everybody in New York City is an adulterer. So what he needed to do was stone everybody. And so he walked out with a little pebbles in his pocket, and he would throw pebbles discreetly at people as he walked by. No joke. He did this, and he writes a book called The Year of Living Biblically. He actually gives a TED talk about it, and there's also a TV show called Living Biblically that just came out this year that's based off of AJ's work. Now, like most of his stunt journalism, it's a gimmick. It attracts attention, it gets a laugh, it makes fun of something, but it raises the question about the Bible. And it portrays the Bible, and he portrays the Bible, of being out of touch with reality, containing standards that are impossible to meet, and being filled with stories that are like fairy tales. See, the Bible, when we go into this Skeptics Wanted series, is probably one of the most important parts of this series, because what we learn about God and Jesus, we pull from the Bible. And of all the different sources out there, this is probably the one that has the most questions about it. Like, how do we know that the Bible is true? How do we know that it's reliable? You know, because most of us, even me, before reading the Bible for myself or starting to learn about the reliability of the Bible, if I never read the Bible or had people help me understand what the Bible was about, I would think the same thing AJ thinks. I would think the Bible is just completely out of touch, irrelevant, and is impossible to follow, and it's just full of tall tales. But somebody helped me understand the Bible. And I want to help you this morning understand the Bible, because if the Christian faith involves learning about God from this book, it's really important for us to ask questions about, can we trust it? Is it reliable? Does it tell the truth? And they're good questions. It's not wrong to ask them. And so this is a place we want you to be comfortable with asking any question about following Jesus or the Bible. And so we're going to take some of these questions on. When I say the Bible, I want to make sure that we're all on the same page about this book, because most of us know the Bible is one book, but it's actually more like this. It's bookshelves with 66 books. A Bible is a collection of books. It's a collection of 66 books, to be exact, and it's split in two. And so from the top here, there's 39 books, which represent the 39 books of the Old Testament before Jesus came. And then Jesus came, and there were letters and books written about Jesus and how to follow Jesus that is represented by 27 books below. That's called the New Testament. And so this collection of books is the Bible. Not just one book that one person wrote, but it's a book that that collects writings of different men that have written about how to follow God and about the Messiah. And so when we're talking about the Bible, that's what we're talking about. Now, there's a lot of people that are skeptical about this book, about this collection of books, rather. But this day and age is not the first time people have been skeptical about the Bible. Even Jesus' followers were skeptical about the Bible. We just celebrated Easter last week, and there's a story that happens right after Easter where these men are traveling along a road from one village to the next village, and they're questioning the Bible, essentially. And they're talking with one another, and Jesus happens to land with them in this conversation. He kind of walks up, joins the conversation, but as they question the Bible, this is what the gospel writer Luke writes about the Bible. He says, Jesus shows up, and this is Jesus' opening line as he talks to these men. He says, "How foolish are you and slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken?" So Jesus' opening line joined the conversation where these guys are like all worried and confused, like, why did Jesus die? And Jesus confronts them like, hey, how dumb can you be to not believe the prophets? And so what's Jesus asking? Why is he to start out like that? And he goes on to say this: "Wasn't it clearly predicted that the Messiah would have to suffer all these things before entering his glory? Then Jesus took them through the writings of Moses and all the prophets, explaining from the scriptures the things concerning himself." What Jesus does with these men on this walk is he takes the Old Testament part of the Bible. This is the scriptures, the sacred writings. There's different phrases and terminology that Jews like Jesus and his companions and religious leaders would have used to describe these 39 books that they saw as how God revealed himself to his people. And Jesus is basically doing on this walk with these men is he's saying, all of these books point to me. So you're confused about why was Jesus, because they don't know he's Jesus yet. If you're wondering, why are you talking about Jesus that way? They don't know he's Jesus yet. And they're confused why he was killed on the cross. Well, look to one of these books. It's a book called Isaiah. Remember the prophet Isaiah? Well, he actually talks about the Messiah would have to be crushed and bruised for our iniquity. He would have to be pierced for our transgressions. And they're thinking about the crucifixion that just happened. And they're starting to connect Isaiah to Jesus. And then for this whole walk from this town to the next town, Jesus then goes and points to the book of Moses. The book of Moses are all the law books. And then he goes through all the prophets. And it says all the scriptures, all these 39 books of the Old Testament actually point to Jesus Christ. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing to be on that walk with Jesus? to have all of these books unfold to point to him. And as soon as they realized the person they were talking to is Jesus, it says that he took off. And this is what happened next. They asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? Their hearts were burning because these truths they had grown up learning now became visible in a new light through Jesus Christ. And their skepticism diminished and their faith in Jesus grew. Are you willing this morning to consider that the Bible is a reliable book, that it's trustworthy and accurate? See, when I started to follow Jesus, I had questions about this book. And as I've met other Christians and people that aren't Christians, I've found that there's lots of questions surrounding these books. And some of the most common questions are these. See, is the Bible historically accurate? You know, hasn't it been proven false? You know, hasn't it changed over time throughout history? You know, it's been changed and adjusted, abbreviated, changed from language to language, and hasn't it made changes? Or aren't there a bunch of contradictions in the Bible? Raise your hand if you've heard any of these questions before, or even thought them yourself. Probably all of us in the room have thought them ourselves as well. And wasn't the Bible written by people who wanted power? See, these are really good questions. They're completely reasonable. But some of us might have grown up in a church culture where if we ever had these questions, the answer was like, just believe. You know, like Christians have been believing for 100 years. What's wrong with you? And that's just not the right heart to have. It's like, it's okay to ask that question. Because the reality is there's good answers to these questions. There's reliable evidence that's given to us as Christians that we should look to. And we don't want to just say, you can't ask that question. No, you can ask any question. Because Jesus, when he taught us as people that we're supposed to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, one of those things isn't just love God with our heart and just have blind faith, but to love God with our mind. Think about what you believe and why you believe it. And it's good to engage your mind and to be thoughtful. Jesus wants us to do that. And so that's what we're going to do this morning. We're going to use our mind a little bit, and we're going to ask, is this book trustworthy? Because one of these questions is, how do we know if this was really what was even originally written in the first place? It's been passed on from year to year, century to century, and is it even still the same? So let's talk through some facts. And fact number one is there are no surviving original copies of the biblical books. Now, this first fact does not build our faith in the Bible. If you pay attention to it, there's no original copies. All right, that's exactly why I think the Bible has been changed and it's inaccurate, because we have copies of it. All right, let's think about this. So we know that we can go to Washington, D.C. We can see the Declaration of Independence, the original copy there. We have an original copy of that, but we don't have an original copy of the Bible. We can't go to Jerusalem and find a book signed by Luke, who was one of Jesus' followers and wrote a book of the Bible. We can't go and find different books of the Bible that are written by the men that are originally wrote them. But when we think about copies today, think about your phone, and I have a scan app on my phone. It's called like Scannable, and I can take a picture of a document and I can scan it and send it to somebody as a PDF. You know, it's really easy to send a copy of something. Before phones and scanning like that, there was fax machines. Anybody here ever used a fax machine before? So, and you're laughing because even that's outdated now, just 10 years ago, and then we were using those things. And then Xerox copies, if you make a Xerox copy, put it in the mail, send it to somebody. Those are reliable copies. Even like if you're in school, we have students here and you're on your math test. Give this a try next time with your math teacher. Say, is this the real, this is a copy of the exam. Is this the real thing? Is this accurate? Is this reliable? We don't question copies. We know that copies today are reliable, but ancient manuscripts we do. We question ancient manuscripts that are written hundreds, even thousands of years ago. Is this really accurate? Or hasn't it been changed over time? So, if we're going to talk about the Bible, it's fair for us to also talk about other ancient literature, because there's some writing that's as old or older than the writings of the Bible. And so one of those guys would be Plato. Anybody here ever read Plato before? My daughter just told me this morning, because she heard the sermon in 9 o'clock service, that she's reading through Plato's Republic. I had no idea. And she also said it's also really boring. but Plato wrote in 300 B.C., But the original and first copy that was written is from 900 AD. So we could pull that graphic up, and we have a little chart for you, because this is how we can tell if ancient writing is reliable or not, through what's called a time lapse and the number of copies. And so for a time lapse, there's 1,200 years between the original and the first time that Plato wrote to the time that we have his first copy, and there's seven copies of Plato. But we read Plato, and we think Plato wrote that. Not only that, his contemporary, Aristotle, who was a little bit older than him, we read Aristotle quotes, we post it on Instagram, and we think that Aristotle said that very thing. And so we have a lot of reliability on Plato and Aristotle, and we have this time lapse of 1,200 and 1,400 years and this number of copies. So let's fast forward just a few hundred years to a guy named Tacitus. You probably don't know who Tacitus is. He's a Roman historian that lived right around the same time that Jesus lived. And I wanted to bring him up because he's more of a contemporary of Jesus and Jesus' followers. And so he wrote around 100 AD, but the first copies we have of his original writings are at 850. So that's much more reliable because the time lapse is smaller, and there's 20 copies. So that's pretty reliable. And all scholars today say that Tacitus is a reliable scholar, a reliable historian. So now this book called the Bible, though, that we like, there's no way that's accurate. You know, it's been changed over time. We can't know for sure that this is what was really written. Really? Check out these numbers. Because the Bible was written right around the same time as Tacitus. The first copies are hundreds of years earlier than that. So the time lapse is less than 100 years. And the number of copies, come on now, 5,686 copies. Now, I know this might not be exciting information for you. You might feel like you're in a class or a lecture right now. But if we're going to ask hard questions, we need to dig down and say, is this book reliable? I think so. The Bible is the gold standard of ancient literature. And so fact number two, even though we don't have the original writings, the Bible exceeds the standard of reliable copies for ancient literature. But the next question is, okay, that's great. So it meets this copy deal. What about the fairy tales in it? What about the stories that are told? Did they actually happen? So let's think about fairy tales real quick. Does anybody have read Jack and the Beanstalk? So where little Jack walks up this beanstalk and he robs a giant monster of magical possessions and runs back down that beanstalk. Now that definitely sounds far-fetched. Or Cinderella, you know, that's probably the leading fairy tale of our age. And Cinderella, you know, she gets a little extreme makeover fairy tale edition. And she has, you know, like plants and people or plants and animals come to life that whisk her off to a ball. Like, of course, we're like, that is totally a fairy tale. And yet people will say the Bible is on the same level as that as well. But the thing about a fairy tale is those stories are told once upon a time in a land far away. But the Bible talks about people that existed in an actual time in actual lands. So when a man and woman were created from the dust of the earth, or this guy built this big boat whose name is Noah to avoid the flood, or Jesus turned water into wine, there's actually writers of the Bible that give specific details and specific locations of these things to make them more believable and verifiable. So we'll go right back to Luke. I started talking about this guy Luke earlier, and I want to talk about Luke because he wrote 25% of these books here, of the New Testament. Luke writes two books that amount for much of the New Testament, and let's just go to him real quick and see what he writes. And he writes this passage in one of his books called Luke chapter 2, verse 1 through 4, where he writes, "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David." Now, the words that are highlighted represent four specific people in four specific places, because the Bible is written about specific people that lived in specific places, even specific times. He's talking about a specific census. It's the first census. And these times and people and places line up even with Tacitus, and they line up with something else called archaeology. See, there's another field of study that we know about where archaeologists are able to dig and find out where people actually lived and what their culture was through some archaeological finds. And we find that many of the things in the Bible are verified by archaeology. The theater that the Apostle Paul preached in is actually really in Athens, the Pool of Siloam, where Jesus healed a blind man really existed. Herod's temple, and on and on and on, place after place. Luke writes about 54 cities, 9 different islands, and 39 countries with complete accuracy that's verified by archaeological evidence. But that's still not enough for some people. See, for centuries, a lot of archaeologists, scholars believed that the Bible wasn't accurate because of this group of people called the Hittites. The Hittites are written about in 13 different books of the Bible, and yet there was no other history outside of the Bible or archaeology that could support this claim of this group of people. And so for years and centuries, up until the early 1900s, people were saying, the Bible's not accurate. This group called the Hittites, they're not around. Until Hugo Winkler, a German archaeologist, you can go Wikipedia or whatever, but he shows up and he unearths this civilization of the Hittites. And it's a huge civilization. It's a prominent civilization based on his findings. And in fact, there's archaeologist after archaeologist that affirms the credibility of the Bible. And so that fairy tale that the Hittites don't exist was laid to rest that day. And many more have been laid to rest through archaeological findings. In fact, one of the most prominent archaeologists at the same time that Hugo lived is a name by Nelson Glueck. He had 1,500 sites that he had excavated and researched. And out of his 1,500 sites, he says this about his findings. It may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever contradicted a biblical reference. That's pretty significant. So if we want to get scholarly, as much as I can get scholarly at least, there's solid evidence about the Bible. We're just starting to scratch the surface, but there's esteemed archaeological research to support the content of the Bible. And so the next question then would be like, okay, so the content stories, they're real people, they're not just fairy tales, but what about all the contradictions, for crying out loud? Doesn't the Bible contradict itself? A Bible teacher that I respect, his name is Dr. Sproul, had a student come to him that told him about, what about all the contradictions? And Dr. Sproul responds to the student, and he says, you know what, the Bible's a big book. Do you think you can find 50 contradictions? He said, easy. The student goes home looking for 50 contradictions to come back to Dr. Sproul the next day. He comes back the next day bleary-eyed with 30. But he still had 30. And so Dr. Sproul sits down with this student and they go through using rules of logic and different Venn diagrams and truth tables and whatnot, being able to discern, is this an actual contradiction or not? And even to the student's satisfaction, both of them agreed, these are not contradictions. None of these things contradict each other. And that day, I believed in the Bible. I'm just kidding, that wasn't me. But that student had his mind changed. Maybe wasn't convinced or turned over to the fact that the Bible is definitely reliable. But he was able to walk away from that straw man argument that I think this comment is a lot. The Bible is full of contradiction. Great, find one. There are some challenging texts. Actually, let's look at one right now. Because there's their top 10 list of contradictions, and there's one about a guy named Judas who was one of Jesus' followers, who was like one of the 12, and he actually betrayed Jesus. If you don't know the story leading up to Easter, he betrayed Jesus, handed him over, got paid for it, but he was so ripped up about it and felt so guilty that he went and hanged himself and killed himself. But there's two stories that are written about Judas that look different. So one is written by Matthew. And Matthew says this about Judas. So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. So the money that he had gained because of betraying Jesus. And then he went away and hanged himself. So there's one account of how Judas died. Second account, with the payment he received for his wickedness, so this is Luke sharing from the book of Acts, for his wickedness, Judas bought a field, and there he fell headlong, his body burst open, and his intestines spilled out. Now, just upon a quick reading of those passages, I know it's a little gruesome, apologize for that, I didn't write it. doesn't that seem different? So doesn't that contradict each other? Well, the laws of contradiction, when we think about what does a contradiction mean, it doesn't mean that there could be two different viewpoints at the same time. For example, if I saw a car hit a pedestrian and it took that pedestrian's life, I would say the car killed the pedestrian. But if a coroner came and said, you know what, and he does like an autopsy and checks out the scene, he's going to give a different report, one that sounds probably a little bit more grotesque like Luke's report. And he's going to talk about the details of that. He's not going to talk about about the car because he didn't see the car. But he's not lying and I'm not lying. So there's two different viewpoints of the same event. And what's happening here with this one story about how Judas dies, there's two different viewpoints. He did go and hang himself. And because of a hot Jerusalem climate, his body, as it hung, decayed and started to decompose. And when he fell from where he was hanging, his body burst open. Doesn't that make sense? So a contradiction, it seems like a seeming contradiction. There's a lot of different ways. There are a lot of different passages, and I'm not even sure that I could, with some of these more challenging ones, can give a great answer to them. But I think if we just spend some good time and think about rules of contradiction, we'll find that that argument doesn't hold a lot of weight. But here's the thing. We can continue to go on. A 30-minute message isn't going to cover all that needs to be covered in this discussion. But what I hope is happening is that you're seeing there is some evidence out there. There is some credibility to this collection of books that we can talk about. But remember what we're talking about today. It's not just a book. It's not just a bookshelf of bookshelf that has a collection of books. You know, there's 66 books that were written by 40 different authors. Some of those authors were historians, poets, kings, fishermen, tax collectors, prophets, most of whom never knew each other, spanning three different continents and three different languages at different times of history, where the time frame is 1,500 years. And all of these men write in this variety of way, and all of their books are put in the one book that reads in an unusual way, just like one book. Just like one story that's being told. Because maybe there is one author of this book. Maybe there is one author that has brought this collection together to tell a more important story about his heart for people, about his desire for people to be connected to him and in a relationship with him. Because the heart of this collection of books is not laws, what must we do to connect with God, but the heart that God has revealed about himself, what I have done to connect to you. And I have sent my son, Jesus Christ, to forgive you of your sins, because these laws, none of us will ever meet them. But Jesus met them for us. And the heart behind this book is what's more important this morning than talking about proof and existence. In fact, in a Bible that I have, the introduction of this Bible, I just want to read it to you because it gets at the heart in a real clear, succinct way. Now, some people think the Bible is a book of rules. Just like our friend A.J. Jacobs, telling you what you should and shouldn't do. The Bible certainly does have some rules in it. They show you how life works best. But the Bible isn't mainly about you and what you should be doing. It's about God and what he has done. Other people think the Bible is a book of heroes showing you people you should copy. The Bible does have some heroes in it, but most of the people in the Bible aren't really heroes at all. In fact, they make some big mistakes, sometimes on purpose. They get afraid and they run away. At times, they're downright mean to each other. The Bible isn't a book of rules or a book of heroes. The Bible is most of all a story. It's an adventure story about a young hero who comes from a far country to win back his lost treasure. It's a love story about a brave prince who leaves his palace, his throne, everything to rescue the one he loves. It's like the most wonderful of fairy tales that's come true in real life. You see, the best thing about this story is it's true. There are lots of stories in the Bible, but all the stories are telling a big story. The story of how God loves his children and comes to rescue them. This is the introduction to a children's Bible that we have for our children. It's called the Jesus Storybook Bible. In fact, we are going to give it to families that dedicate their children next month, May 20th. We're going to have a child dedication. And this Bible and this book does a great job of doing what Jesus did with his disciples, is pointing all 66 of these books to Jesus Christ and the heart of God. And the first time I read this Bible with my children is when I really started to see the Bible come together for myself, to be honest with you. To see how clearly every story in the Bible points to Jesus Christ. See, it's not just a book. It's a book that has the heart of God beating behind it, why he came. He didn't want us to be crushed for keeping the rules and the laws. He crushed Jesus in our place. He didn't want a book to keep us to live a certain way, but to free us to be able to live for him. That's what this book is about. It's a great book. Now, we live in a Western culture where we have really easy access to this collection of books. You could pull it up on your phone right now if you have internet access. We have free Bibles in the back that you can grab. You can go home and go onto the internet and look and read the Bible anytime we want. But there are people in our world that actually don't have a copy of the Bible in their own language or at all. And they've heard some stories told orally, but they've never physically read the Bible for themselves. And I want to show you a video of a group of people getting a Bible for the first time. Because I think this video portrays how we as Westerners should view and see the Bible together. So let's check it out. I love that video because that's the heart and passion I want to have and the appreciation that I want for having this collection of books to be able to read this, not to have to read it. Maybe it's a book that you feel like you've had to read at times in your life, but that we get to read. See, I love the respect as those men walk up together to receive their first Bible. It's just an honor and appreciation of the revealed word of God to them. I want that. And I think of one of the prophets. So one of these books is written by a guy named Jeremiah. And he talks about receiving words from God like this. He says, "When I discovered your words, I devoured them. They are my joy and my heart's delight, for I bear your name, O Lord God of heaven's armies." See, I want for us to have that response to the Bible. That the Bible isn't something we have to read or we should read, but it's something that when we get our hands on it, we devour it, and it brings joy and delight to us. Because when we get the heart of the Bible, it's about God connecting to us and having a relationship with us, we will have that type of experience as we read the Bible. And I want to be able to help you even take your next step. If you don't have a current Bible reading plan, there's two options that I want to give you this morning. One is to go to that book called Luke. It's about the life of Jesus. There's 24 chapters in it. If you read a chapter a day, you'll wrap it up by May 1st. And you can read and just start to read God's word for yourself. Or there's another plan that we refer to a lot called the E100. We have plans out at the Next Steps area for you, or it's on a Bible app called YouVersion. If you want to make sure you get information from us, write down on your Connect card, send that E100 to me, or help me know what other Bible plans are, and we'll send you that information electronically. Because we'd love for you and to help you to succeed and win in reading the Bible. The E100 stands for Essential 100 Passages of the Bible. And so it gives you a big picture view of this great book. And my hope for all of us this morning is that as we read this Bible and it points to Jesus Christ, that we find joy and delight in it. Let me pray.